Eves, a novel by Valerie Werder. Part 2, Buying. Chapter 4. Valerie lay in bed most nights with her eyes wide open to the cavernous dark, listening with a sense of dread to her own breathing. She felt the spaces between her ribs expand as she filled her lungs. Was she sensing movement or sound? She couldn't tell. Even her most silent shifts in the bed seemed so loud in the dark. She imagined the night air passing through her throat, her lungs, mixing about with her insides, and then, on an exhale, smuggling bits of her away with it. She didn't want it to take the secret parts, the parts that Julie, sleeping in the other bed, shouldn't know. In the daytime, it seemed unlikely to Valerie that her sister could read her mind. But night heightened the ticks and moans of pipes in the house, brushed up against oil slicks left by skin on walls and bedsheets, broadcasting, Valerie worried, her uncertain fantasies against the walls. Even with the bedroom door closed as much as her parents permitted, a thin strip of hallway light cut across the carpet and bed frame and outlined her 2 feet like small animals underneath the comforter. She placed a pillow over her face to insulate the secret thoughts from both darkness and sister. Sufficiently concealed, she could visualize herself naked and supine on a conveyor belt, the kind of device she'd seen in documentaries and cartoons featuring factory workers. The body on the belt, though, was not Valerie's actual body, but rather a kind of impersonal, animate mannequin. Other animate mannequins lay alongside her, a row of identical, putty-hued forms flat on the line as far as she could see. Valerie kicked her feet in her bed, and the small animals flinched underneath her comforter. In the fantasy, her feet, arched in plastic, dangled midair off the assembly line. She squeezed her eyes beneath the pillow, altering the vision. A cold metal partition appeared, about 3 feet high and with rectangular cutouts framing the mannequin's waists, running down the middle of the belt and cutting lower halves off from upper, dangling feet no longer visible. How had the mannequins gotten there? They lay down on the line, Valerie decided, and with a pull of a lever, the machine's operator clamped the metal partition down upon them, holding them in place. Valerie turned her mannequin face to the side, replicating the imagined action by turning, too, her face below the pillow. Examining the other women for particularities, distinct jawlines or veiny eyelids or silky mustache hairs. There were none. The bodies on the conveyor belt were interchangeable. Carefully, Valerie moved her pillow from face to abdomen to replicate the feeling of the partition. Shadowy workers monitored the other side of the metal barrier, she knew, mechanical as automated factory machines, and obscured from view. These men stood in position, pumping their hips into the mannequins from the other side of the partition, as the conveyor belt inched along, moving Valerie from one partner to the next. As the men worked, Valerie smiled at the mannequin next to her, who wore the same generic face. They looked like clichés, housewives in advertisements for cleaning products and sandwich meats, with dimpled cheeks and soft eyelashes. Their mouths were the color of the lipstick Valerie had taken from her grandmother's makeup drawer the week before, craving coral, or maybe committed coral. The mannequins paid little attention to the bodies operating on the other side of the partition, whose gestures were automatic, the least personal act in the world. Unable to conjure up how intercourse, as her mom called it, might feel, Valerie supposed that each man felt exactly the same. She focused on the face of the woman that was also her face, the lipstick that was also her grandmother's lipstick. It should be clear, but nonetheless, Valerie's bed is far from a personal space. The fantasies produced there are far from original. The bed is the size and shape of beds across America, beds in college dormitories, in hospital wards, in recovery center rooms, though hers is a hand-me-down with elegant wood spires where wrist and ankle restraints could conceivably be installed, a compelling notion that did not escape our protagonist. The bed is positioned within Valerie's room so that a parent can peer in, observe a child sleeping sweetly, or pretending to do so. Valerie's grandfather had had a home office for his dentistry practice. He built a couch and a desk for the office and, afterward, used the scrap wood to build twin beds for his twin sons. What determines the proper size of a bed? The mattress that will come to rest upon it. Valerie's grandfather sent his wife to the department store with a measuring tape to determine standard mattress dimensions. What determines the dimensions of a mattress? The bureaucratic tentacle of the state. The state? Well, yes, the United States. Mattress sizes differ from country to country, and regulations determine not only standard sizes, but also materials to be used, permissible levels of toxic chemicals, measures to be taken against flammability, etc. Who knows what Valerie's imagination might have done had U.S. officials and bureaucrats settled on slightly different sizes for children's bedding. In waking life, small brown moles began cropping up on Valerie's shoulders, forearms, abdomen, thighs. Beauty marks, her father reassured her as she itched and picked at them, leaving constellations of scars and scabs laughing at her from her limbs. She tried to scrape them away, but the moles grew right back, making her body more individual, recognizable. Her limbs and their imperfections belonged to her. A horrible realization. The moles would compromise her anonymity on the conveyor belt. She imagined them spreading, her lower half infested with beauty marks of all sizes. The men on the other side of the machine would know. They would be repulsed by her body's stubborn outcroppings, its failure to conform. Or maybe they'd be happy for the variety, a new thing to stick there. She couldn't say the word, couldn't even think it. Parts in. I never asked for this. She scratched at a particularly inflamed scab on her left elbow. I never wanted this body. She imagined being made only of thought, silvery tendrils of dream stuff whirling about in the ether, or maybe fragments of text, hanging indents, a blinking cursor. Impossible. The thoughts had to be somewhere, and that somewhere, whatever it was, would be a body. Why call them beauty marks? She asked. Her father was sitting, tired, at the head of the kitchen table in the early evening, shirt sleeves pushed up around forearms, beer in hand. His response came perfunctory. Because they make you unique. She slunk away, dissatisfied. Uniqueness shouldn't be a function of the body, out of her control. Unique was what she could get at the store, the aisle of sodas at the supermarket, or eye creams at CVS. Small, calculable markers that corresponded to some kind of meaning. This one means this, and that one that, and so on. Unique shouldn't have to do with what she couldn't help, the growths and eruptions of the body. At CVS, Valerie stood before the CoverGirl section and surveyed concealers and powders, one designed for blemishes with chemicals and cool green undertones, another with SPF and retinol for mature skin, another with a smiling brunette in a sequined dress, promising 18-hour lasting coverage. She looked over her shoulder a few times, studied a man in belted chinos who'd stopped a dozen feet away in front of the laxatives, waited until he pulled a box from the shelf to examine the instructions on the side, and slipped the long-lasting concealer into her jacket's sleeve, adjusting its elastic wristband so the contraband would stay in place. The next morning, she locked herself in the bathroom, shaved her arms and stomach, and carefully dotted Ivory 330 over the beauty marks until her skin was as uniform as she'd seen it at the factory the night before. Chapter 5. Years later, in October or maybe September, Valerie saved the letters and sales pitches she'd been drafting, shut down her computer, and took the elevator to reception, where Sylvie was watering the battery of orchids barricading the reception desk. They were the last to leave the gallery. Sylvie pressed the 4-digit code to alarm the building and rushed for the door as the security system counted toward lockdown. It was long past dark. On the subway downtown, the girls exchanged exhaustions, and by the time they arrived at the bar in Queens, Valerie was mute, skin slack and slick with city scum. She tracked bargoers' expressions and gestures without speaking, while Sylvie's eyes grew large and streams of words tumbled out of her mouth. Small islands of bodies congregated around plastic cocktail tables. Sylvie led Valerie through the crowd on the patio to find their friend, Maria, pushing past solid forms emanating heat through cheap cotton and spandex. Red plastic straws jostled liquor and soda in Valerie's cup, condensation slurring across her palm. She put her other hand in her pocket to touch the 5 or 6 sugar cubes she'd taken from the bar's condiment tray while the bartender's back was turned. The cube's hard edges softened under her fingers, and she brought hand to nose to smell, but her fingertips didn't smell like anything but themselves. This dampened her pleasure at getting the cubes without asking for them. She'd have to get rid of them soon, before she was tempted to pop them in her mouth during a lull in conversation. She dropped 2 on the ground while Sylvie wasn't looking. With a flick of her wrist, she threw another in a fake terracotta planter holding a fake tropical plant. The cube hit the plant's trunk and bounced across the floor. Maria was holding a table for them, sober, hoping that an unnamed friend might stop by with Coke later in the night. She wore a baseball cap and oversized glasses and held a cup of seltzer into which she ashed her cigarette over melting ice cubes. She and Sylvie spoke, eyes locked, Maria sliding into Portuguese to complain about the latest frustration at the art magazine she edited, a new editor campaigning for objective and impartial reviews of gallery exhibitions. The last words Valerie caught before the conversation was entirely lost to her were incestuous and roommates. Sylvie responded in brisk Portuguese as Valerie folded her straw into 4 parts, and then 8, and then 16. She did not speak Portuguese or any language besides English. Valerie set the straw on the patio table, where it unfurled like a demented snake. Techno coursed from the concrete, and Sylvie's smoke intermingled with their visible exhalations in the cold. The scene was external and still, a movie set in service of Maria and Sylvie's rapid conversation. Valerie screened a film of herself onto the back of her eyelids, trying to concoct an important and well-formed sentence to reintroduce a language she could speak into the conversation. But when Sylvie paused, polite, and asked, in English, what Valerie was thinking, she didn't come up with anything to say. The door to the bar opened, and 2 girls in fake fur coats and long braids stumbled out, their drinks preceding them onto the patio. Nick, an art critic and part-time gallerist of indeterminate but well-groomed origin, emerged from behind the stumblers and approached Sylvie, putting his arm around her waist and gently moving her to the side by way of a greeting. Nick was compact and coolly energetic, with a muscular jaw and wire-rimmed glasses. Maria barely took note of him, turning her attention from the now occupied Sylvie toward Valerie. Maria was a quick and brilliant monologuist, and Valerie only had to nod whenever she paused, indicating agreement while, in reality, she grew lazy, slouching against the plastic lawn chair, attention occupied almost entirely by the way her jacket rose and fell over her abdomen. Neither Maria nor Sylvie wore clothes that betrayed their bodies, or else they had the kind of neat and self-contained bodies that didn't announce their digestive functions and breathing patterns. What to do with this bloated sack of organs and thoughts? Valerie fingered the remaining 2 sugar cubes in her pocket. Hey, Nick said, eyes fixed upon Maria's mouth. I know you from somewhere. I remember you. That gap between your teeth. It's one of the most subtle tooth gaps I've ever seen. There was no way to respond. Maria frowned at him and turned to Sylvie. I'm going inside for another drink. I'll catch up with you later. Walking home, Sylvie told Valerie about a theory she'd developed as Nick shepherded her from table to table. Androids shaped like women are so creepy in sci-fi movies, she said, bony shoulders jutting into Valerie's as they tripped over the crumbling sidewalk, because they're not at all committed to their bodies. They know they've been fabricated. There's no pretense that they're natural or that their form has any kind of meaning. Right. An android's body is pure utility, agreed Valerie. So if she cares about what she looks like, it's only because she needs to be incognito enough to accomplish her goal. Not because she cares about beauty or cuteness or whatever for its own sake. You can't distract a murdering android by saying, that gap between your teeth is cute. Yeah, if she was designed with a tooth gap, it was probably only so she could distract CIA officers while she stabs them in the kidneys anyway. Seriously, what was that with the tooth gap? The subtle tooth gap? I don't know, some kind of connoisseurial approach to women, I guess. Sylvie remembered a college boyfriend who remarked upon her tiny ears or feet every time he felt nervous or insecure or bored in arguments. The compliments jolted her from language, reminding her of her hairline, her eye shape, what her face looked like in the mirror, how her mouth moved when she spoke. The compliments did their job. They rendered her mute. But without Sylvie filling the role of respondent, without her agreements and affirmations and assurances, the boyfriend, too, became unsure of himself, faltered, fell silent. If I were an android designer, I'd make sure to implant the most complex gear in the cutest parts. Like, my android would have super advanced hearing and recording devices stored in tiny ears. Yeah, that's great, because tiny ears are both cute and a kind of impediment, right? Like, the CIA officer thinks he's really talking to this regular girl at the bar, tells her he wants to get closer to make sure she can hear him, because she's got the tiniest, cutest ears. And that's how the android gets him. Knife right into the soft part of the skull. Jesus. Sorry, I just meant, if anything, she's happy about her tiny ears. They're the best disguise. Chapter 6. The next morning, Valerie clawed her way out of a disturbed sleep. She was plastered to her mattress in a cocoon of dried sweat and heavy limbs, the night's dreams struggling to surface and come to a conclusion before the day's urgent tasks stole them away. In sleep, she, Sylvie, and Maria had been automatons in a New York filled with human men and replicated women. The women were happy to be homogenous. They'd proposed and voted upon the procedure themselves. Valerie and Sylvie discovered, delighted, that they often fell in step due to the identical length and composition of their legs. The dream began in a rigidly stratified New York. People could predict each other's occupations, where they lived, how much money they made, their favorite bars, their fetishes, how often they called their parents, etc., with a cursory glance at a face, a name, a hereditary chart. Valerie, for example, could easily be sorted into a genre populated by other 20-something, tote-bag-carrying, art-gallery-going, suburban-childhood-having humans. Despite the fact that, sociologically speaking, Sylvie, Maria, and Valerie were roughly interchangeable, they found their minor particularities, small ears framed by a tawny crew cut, a charming snaggle tooth, under eye circles that fluctuated between you look a little sleepy and borderline mauve, being picked out and deployed against them. Similarly, their banal transgressions and neuroses, regular lunches of wine and oyster crackers, only getting off to muscular gay porn, compulsively ignoring accumulating mounds of student debt, were considered deep, shameful secrets peculiar to them and only them. Slowly, the three discovered that other genres of professional women felt the same way. Maybe Maria had been sharing stories with an apathetic luxury car advertiser, or maybe Valerie overheard a conversation at a poetry reading. Regardless of its origin, someone began a group chat, which quickly ballooned into a conversation between hundreds, and then nearly 2,000. It was easy to pretend that the group represented the totality of women existing in the world, or maybe in all of eternity, because the message thread was so rapid and continuous. Statements appeared one after another from unrecognized numbers, and Valerie's guess was as good as anyone's as to who, precisely, her interlocutors were. Such naivete, feigned by Valerie's subconscious and excused by digital anonymity, is easy to dismiss with a cursory review of the group's formation. Its network exhausted the social contacts of a select set of professional women living in New York, ages 25 to 60, and better represented those who hired house cleaners than those who cleaned houses. Around 9 p.m. on a Friday evening, Dream Valerie picked up her phone after a shower and nap to find 637 new message alerts. The thread had recently turned to a museum curator's anger at being singled out by colleagues for a rather prominent mole under her left eye, and a 917 number proposed that all the women in the city do away with their human bodies, implanting themselves instead into mechanized shells. You know, that's not a half bad idea. They'd really have to come up with new ways to take us down a notch. You know they would come up with ways. But at least we'd get a few days of reprieve. Actually, I think someone in the group works in AI at Data Lab. This could seriously be possible. What the fuck? Really? Hey, yeah, it's me that works for Data Lab. I'm head of design technology and robotics. My name's Gretchen. Valerie opted to not voice an opinion, waiting for the phone numbers of the only two women she knew, Sylvie and Maria, to pop up in the chat. 4 minutes later, Maria opined, "Yeah, God, this would be such a relief." Concerns about funding were raised. One member was quite wealthy and assured the rest she'd tap into the usual philanthropic networks. An 845 number wondered, "How will we get all the other women in the city, the women who aren't in the group, on board?" A prominent intellectual promised to write an op-ed in the Times. She'd argue for a beautiful sense of equality, freedom from objectification, release from appearances. A 718 number repeatedly asked what the automated bodies would look like, suggesting maybe we should neutralize race, select an unnatural color like blue or gray or purple. Members were not sure. Objections were raised, anxieties duly noted. The group would put their collective body's physical appearance to a vote. On the day of the vote, Maria refused to participate. "They've got Gretchen from Design Lab making the thing. I know her. It doesn't matter if it's gold or magenta or teal. Any automaton made by Gretchen is going to look like Barbarella fell into a vat of Pantone." Indeed, the final design was silver, with a poofy wig and a button nose. Once automated, it was near impossible to tell which body belonged to your friend, colleague, girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, and so on. The women didn't trust each other, and for good reason. After implantation in their silvery new bodies, an initial sense of peace in the city was followed by a great and sudden confusion. Thieving women snuck into homes and workplaces not their own, taking computers and appliances and the like. Identical women emptied one another's bank accounts, kidnapped those in higher positions to insert themselves by proxy into alternate lives. If you were able to remember a friend's distinctive walk, flat-footed, slow, or the sour expression she made when she was being insulted, and if you could detect a trace of this gesture on a silvery automaton, you could hazard a guess at the automaton's identity. Most women, though, were loath to reveal who they were, and even the most idiosyncratic gestures could be imitated by a highly skilled identity thief. In a well-publicized case, one woman, a professor, locked up her ex's new girlfriend and took her place, thinking she'd be able to regain her former paramour's affections, if only by posing as her new love. The presumed ex, though, turned out to also be an identity thief, a woman with tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt and medical bills, who was squatting in the wealthy ex's apartment, paying off her loans using the ex's credit cards. During courtroom proceedings, the identity thief said she'd barely had to do any work to convince the professor that she was, in fact, her former love. She'd looked through bank statements and old receipts, watched a few videos. Easy. Reporters covering the case found it difficult to transcribe court proceedings, having no way to tell which woman was speaking at any given time. They began to confuse themselves with their interviewees, and lawyers with criminals, and soon all the women were speaking in tandem, completing each other's sentences, infecting each other with the desire to sabotage the entire project. It was a mess. Officials couldn't determine whether a large majority of women were suddenly participating in criminal activity, or whether a small group of deviants had taken advantage of the new system, mucked it all up. Crime rates tripled, and police were loath to arrest the hard, silvery women. The women in the group were astounded. They had not predicted this. In the confusion, Silvery Valerie wandered around Union Square, where, in her previous life, pickup artists and peddlers approached her while she was eating 50-cent hard-boiled eggs and scrolling through art world blogs. For several days, she watched an automaton with the mannerisms of Sylvie, who leaned against the fake brick of the Whole Foods, smoking, eyeing groups of Guinean men with glinting black plastic bags, who sang, "Louis, Gucci, Hermes, Celine, snap 'em up before the police do." A select few women had escaped the automation decree by faking homelessness, dressing in shapeless men's clothes, and hiding in subway stations smelling of urine, speaking senseless languages, or acting otherwise deranged. Of those remaining unautomated, it was, in the end, impossible to tell who had once been a woman and who not. The Silvery Valerie didn't care. She studied the automaton she assumed was Sylvie, as the Sylvie studied the peddlers. "Hey," the Valerie ventured, stepping beside the Sylvie but not looking at her face. "Do you know of a good place to get coffee around here?" The Sylvie looked at her sharply, squinting, not speaking. The Valerie tried again. "I like that gap between your teeth." The Sylvie grabbed her forearm. "It's you." The two went off in search of Maria's, finding several candidates. One, who wore a baseball cap and eagerly engaged in exchanges with strangers, which the Sylvie thought suspiciously unlike aloof Maria. Another, who sat on stoops and leaned against buildings with the exact comportment the Sylvie knew so well. And a third, combative, who snuck, stealthy, around the city with some sort of plan the two couldn't quite figure out, marking advertisements and photographing men at random. They stalked these Marias for days. The Valerie, exhausted and despairing, begged the Sylvie for a break. Maybe a drink, she suggested, or a trip to the Russian bathhouse. "Absolutely not," the Sylvie said. She'd become obsessed with the three Marias, didn't want to abandon pursuit for even a few hours, fearing that if the two stopped following their targets, other automated women would come in and replace the Marias, kidnap or hide or kill the Marias, and the Valerie and the Sylvie would be none the wiser. After much persuasion, the Sylvie finally agreed to an hour in the steam room, advising against intoxication of any form in the current political climate. The two women walked to the baths on St. Mark's, took towels from the hairy and pot-bellied attendant, and undressed. A thick cloud of steam obscured the women's vision, and the Valerie and the Sylvie were barely able to see their own knees through the dull white vapor. The two sat side by side, silent, and the Valerie watched in confused amazement as shapes grew on her legs. A heat rash. "Are you embarrassed to be naked?" the Sylvie asked, frowning. "No," the Valerie replied. "It's just a rash." "Oh, I thought maybe you were blushing." The Valerie considered this. The body wasn't really hers. It was the same as the Sylvie's, the same as all the others. Could she really be ashamed of something so stupidly repetitive? "Look, it's happening to me too." The Sylvie pressed at her thighs, marking bluish splotches in the middle of gray, her rash extending from knees to thighs. "Creepy." The Valerie poked at her thigh, and then the Sylvie's. The rashes were different. "Let's get out of here." "No, wait." The Sylvie paused. "We have to remember the patterns. We'll come back tomorrow and see if they're the same, and if they are, we can recognize each other. Test who we're talking to. Make sure you're always you, Maria is always Maria. Once we find her. If we find her." "But do you really want to be able to tell?" the Valerie began to ask, standing up, the room spinning, light filtering in through the steam. And then the dream was distinct from Valerie, splintered off from her body and incompatible with the reality in which she found herself. She was awake. On an evening run through a Hasidic section of East Williamsburg a few days later, she realized that the dream automaton Sylvie may have been trying to sabotage her, but she had no way of accessing the dream version of herself to warn her. Chapter 7. It is necessary to establish here that it is by design that the two halves of Valerie cannot communicate with each other. A pair, after all, can't coexist peaceably. Put side by side, Valerie learned in chemistry, or maybe psychology, two will tend to establish a hierarchy. Sleepy and sneaky Valerie trying to trick waking Valerie. Waking Valerie oppressing her psychic twin. It's necessary that they be kept at a distance, that they communicate only across the thin neural veil that sometimes distinguishes sleep from waking. In this way, they can neither cohere nor compete, although they sometimes overlap, merge and entangle, only to separate and repel each other once again. Which one can claim ownership of the name they share? Who is the rightful protagonist of this story? Both are doomed to fail at this task, this senseless contest for possession of Valerie.